Chapter 11. Her name was Alice Maxwell. She could tell them that much. And she could tell them that she and her mother had come into Boston on the train, from Boxford, she said, to do some shopping, a thing they often did on Wednesday, which she called her short day at the high school she attended. She said they'd gotten off the train at South Station and grabbed a cab. She said the cab driver had been wearing a blue turban. She said the blue turban was the last thing she could remember until the bald desk clerk had finally unlocked the shattered double doors of the Atlantic Avenue Inn and let her in. Clay thought she remembered more. He based this on the way she began to tremble when Tom McCourt asked her if either she or her mother had been carrying a cell phone. She claimed not to remember, but Clay was sure one or both of them had been. Everyone did these days, it seemed. He was just the exception that proved the rule. And there was Tom, who might owe his life to the cat that had knocked his off the counter. They conversed with Alice. The conversation consisted, for the most part, of Clay asking questions while the girl sat mutely, looking down at her scraped knees and shaking her head from time to time, in the hotel lobby. Clay and Tom had moved Franklin's body behind the reception desk, dismissing the bald clerk's loud and bizarre protest that "it will be just under my feet there." The clerk, who had given his name simply as Mr. Riccardi, had since retired to his inner office. Clay had followed him just long enough to ascertain that Mr. Riccardi had been telling the truth about the TV being out of commish, then left him there. Sharon Riddell would have said Mr. Riccardi was brooding in his tent. The man hadn't let Clay go without a parting shot, however. "Now we're open to the world," he said bitterly. "I hope you think you've accomplished something." "Mr. Riccardi," Clay said, as patiently as he could, "I saw a plane crash land on the other side of Boston Common not an hour ago. It sounds like more planes, big ones, are doing the same thing at Logan. Maybe they're even making suicide runs on the terminals. There are explosions all over downtown. I'd say that this afternoon all of Boston is open to the world." As if to underline this point, a very heavy thump had come from above them. Mr. Riccardi didn't look up. He only flapped a begone hand in Clay's direction. With no TV to look at, he sat in his desk chair and looked severely at the wall. Chapter 12. Clay and Tom moved the two bogus Queen Anne chairs against the door, where their high backs did a pretty good job of filling the shattered frames that had once held glass. While Clay was sure that locking the hotel off from the street offered flimsy or outright false security, he thought that blocking the view from the street might be a good idea, and Tom had concurred. Once the chairs were in place, they lowered the sun blind over the lobby's main window. That dimmed the room considerably and sent faint prison bar shadows marching across the turkey red rug. With these things seen to, and Alice Maxwell's radically abridged tale told, Clay finally went to the telephone behind the desk. He glanced at his watch. It was 4:22 p.m., a perfectly logical time for it to be, except any ordinary sense of time seemed to have been canceled. It felt like hours since he'd seen the man biting the dog in the park. It also seemed like no time at all. But there was time, such as humans measured it anyway, and in Kent Pond, Sharon would surely be back by now at the house he still thought of as home. He needed to talk to her, to make sure she was all right, and tell her he was too. But those weren't the important things. Making sure Johnny was all right, that was important. But there was something even more important than that. Vital, really. He didn't have a cell phone, and neither did Sharon. He was almost positive of that. She might have picked one up since they'd separated in April, he supposed, but they still lived in the same town. He saw her almost every day, and he thought if she'd picked one up, he would have known. For one thing, she would have given him the number, right? Right. But Johnny had one. Little Johnny G, who wasn't so little anymore, 12 wasn't so little, and that was what he'd wanted for his last birthday. A red cell phone that played the theme music from his favorite TV program when it rang. Of course, he was forbidden to turn it on or even take it out of his backpack when he was in school, but school hours were over now. Also, Clay and Sharon actually encouraged him to take it, partly because of the separation, There might be emergencies or minor inconveniences, such as a missed bus. What Clay had to hang on to was how Sharon had said she'd look into Johnny's room lately, and more often than not, see the cell lying forgotten on his desk or the windowsill beside his bed, off the charger and dead as dog shit. Still, the thought of John's red cell phone ticked away in his mind like a bomb. Clay touched the landline phone on the hotel desk, then withdrew his hand. Outside, something else exploded, but this one was distant. It was like hearing an artillery shell explode when you were well behind the lines. Don't make that assumption, he thought. Don't even assume there are lines. He looked across the lobby and saw Tom squatting beside Alice as she sat on the sofa. He was murmuring to her quietly, touching one of her loafers and looking up into her face. That was good. He was good. Clay was increasingly glad he'd run into Tom McCourt, or that Tom McCourt had run into him. The landlines were probably all right. The question was whether probably was good enough. He had a wife who was still sort of his responsibility, and when it came to his son, there was no sort of at all. Even thinking of Johnny was dangerous. Every time his mind turned to the boy, Clay felt a panic rat inside his mind, ready to burst free of the flimsy cage that held it and start gnawing anything it could get at with its sharp little teeth. If he could make sure Johnny and Sharon were okay, he could keep the rat in its cage and plan what to do next. But if he did something stupid, he wouldn't be able to help anyone. In fact, he would make things worse for the people here. He thought about this a little, and then called the desk clerk's name. When there was no answer from the inner office, he called again. When there was still no answer, he said, "I know you hear me, Mr. Riccardi. If you make me come in there and get you, it'll annoy me. I might get annoyed enough to consider putting you out on the street." "You can't do that," Mr. Riccardi said in a tone of surly instruction. "You are a guest of the hotel." Clay thought of repeating what Tom had said to him while they were still outside. Things have changed. Something made him keep silent instead. "What?" Mr. Riccardi said at last, sounding more surly than ever. From overhead came a louder thump, as if someone had dropped a heavy piece of furniture, a bureau maybe. This time even the girl looked up. Clay thought he heard a muffled shout, or maybe a howl of pain, but if so, there was no follow-up. What was on the second floor? Not a restaurant, he remembered being told by Mr. Riccardi himself when Clay checked in, that the hotel didn't have a restaurant, but the Metropolitan Cafe was right next door. Meeting rooms, he thought. I'm pretty sure it's meeting rooms with Indian names. What? Mr. Riccardi asked again. He sounded grouchier than ever. Did you try to call anyone when all this started happening? Well, of course, Mr. Riccardi said. He came to the door between the inner office and the area behind the reception desk, with its pigeonholes, security monitors, and its bank of computers. There he looked at Clay indignantly. The fire alarms went off. I got them stopped. Doris said it was a wastebasket fire on the third floor, and I called the fire department to tell them not to bother. The line was busy. Busy, can you imagine? You must have been very upset, Tom said. Mr. Riccardi looked mollified for the first time. I called the police when things outside started, you know, to go downhill. Yes, Clay said. To go downhill was one way of putting it, all right. Did you get an answer? A man told me I'd have to clear the line and then hung up on me, Mr. Riccardi said. The indignation was creeping back into his voice. When I called again, this was after the crazy man came out of the elevator and killed Franklin, a woman answered. She said... Mr. Riccardi's voice had begun to quiver, and Clay saw the first tears running down the narrow defiles that marked the sides of the man's nose. Said? What? Tom asked in that same tone of mild sympathy. What did she say, Mr. Riccardi? She said, if Franklin was dead, and the man who killed him had run away, then I didn't have a problem. It was she who advised me to lock myself in. She also told me to call the hotel's elevators to lobby level and shut them off, which I did. Clay and Tom exchanged a look that carried a wordless thought. Good idea. Clay got a sudden vivid image of bugs trapped between a closed window and a screen, buzzing furiously, but unable to get out. This picture had something to do with the thumps they'd heard coming from above them. He wondered briefly how long before the thumper, or thumpers up there, would find the stairs.
Then she hung up on me. After that, I called my wife in Milton.
You got through to her, Clay said, wanting to be clear on this.
She was very frightened. She asked me to come home. I told her I had been advised to stay inside with the doors locked. Advised by the police. I told her to do the same thing. Lock up and keep a, you know, low profile. She begged me to come home. She said there had been gunshots on the street and an explosion a street over. She said she had seen a naked man running through the Benzicks' yard. The Benzicks live next door to us.
Yes, Tom said mildly, soothingly even. Clay said nothing.
He was a bit ashamed at how angry he'd been at Mr. Riccardi.
But Tom had been angry too.
She said she believed the naked man might, she only said might, have been carrying the body of a nude child, but possibly it was a doll. She begged me again to leave the hotel and come home.
Clay had what he needed. The landlines were safe. Mr. Riccardi was in shock, but not crazy. Clay put his hand on the telephone. Mr. Riccardi laid his hand over Clay's before Clay could pick up the receiver. Mr. Riccardi's fingers were long and pale and very cold. Mr. Riccardi wasn't done. Mr. Riccardi was on a roll.
She called me a son of a bitch and hung up. I know she was angry with me, and of course I understand why. But the police told me to lock up and stay put. The police told me to keep off the streets. The police! The authorities!
Clay nodded. The authorities, sure.
Did you come by the tea? Mr. Riccardi asked. I always use the tea. It's just 2 blocks down the street. It's very convenient.
It wouldn't be convenient this afternoon, Tom said. After what we just saw, you couldn't get me down there on a bet. Mr. Riccardi looked at Clay with mournful eagerness.
You see?
Clay nodded again. You're better off in here, he said, knowing that he meant to get home and see to his boy. Sharon, too, of course, but mostly his boy. Knowing he would let nothing stop him unless something absolutely did. It was like a weight in his mind that cast an actual shadow on his vision. Much better off. Then he picked up the phone and punched 9 for an outside line. He wasn't sure he'd get one, but he did. He dialed 1, then 207, the area code for all of Maine, and then 692, which was the prefix for Kent Pond and the surrounding towns. He got 3 of the last 4 numbers, almost to the house he still thought of as home, before the distinctive 3-tone interrupt. A recorded female voice followed. We're sorry. All circuits are busy. Please try your call again later. On the heels of this came a dial tone as some automated circuit disconnected him from Maine, if that was where the robot voice had been coming from. Clay let the handset drop to the level of his shoulder, as if it had grown very heavy. Then he put it back in the cradle. Chapter 13. Tom told him he was crazy to want to leave. For one thing, he pointed out, they were relatively safe here in the Atlantic Avenue Inn, especially with the elevators locked down and lobby access from the stairwell blocked off. This they had done by piling boxes and suitcases from the luggage room in front of the door at the end of the short corridor beyond the elevator banks. Even if someone of extraordinary strength were to push against that door from the other side, he'd only be able to shift the pile against the facing wall, creating a gap of maybe 6 inches, not enough to get through. For another, the tumult in the city beyond their little safe haven actually seemed to be increasing. There was a constant racket of conflicting alarms, shouts and screams, and racing engines, and sometimes the panic tang of smoke, although the day's brisk breeze seemed to be carrying the worst of that away from them. So far, Clay thought, but did not say aloud, at least not yet. He didn't want to frighten the girl any more than she already was. There were explosions that never seemed to come singly, but rather in spasms. One of those was so close that they all ducked, sure the front window would blow in. It didn't. But after that, they moved to Mr. Riccardi's inner sanctum. The third reason Tom gave for thinking Clay was crazy to even think about leaving the marginal safety of the inn was that it was now 5:15. The day would be ending soon. He argued that trying to leave Boston in the dark would be madness.
"Just take a gander out there,"
he said, gesturing to Mr. Riccardi's little window, which looked out on Essex Street. Essex was crowded with abandoned cars. There was also at least one body, that of a young woman in jeans and a Red Sox sweatshirt. She lay face down on the sidewalk, both arms outstretched, as if she had died trying to swim. "Veritech," her sweatshirt proclaimed.
"Do you think you're going to drive your car? If you do, you better think again."
"He's right," Mr. Riccardi said. He was sitting behind his desk with his arms once more folded across his narrow chest, a study in gloom.
"You're in the Tamworth Street parking garage. I doubt if you'd even succeed in securing your keys."
Clay, who had already given his car up as a lost cause, opened his mouth to say he wasn't planning to drive, at least to start with, when another thump came from overhead, this one heavy enough to make the ceiling shiver. It was accompanied by the faint but distinctive shiver jingle of breaking glass. Alice Maxwell, who was sitting in the chair across the desk from Mr. Riccardi, looked up nervously and then seemed to shrink further into herself.
"What's up there?"
Tom asked.
"It's the Iroquois room directly overhead," Mr. Riccardi replied. "The largest of our three meeting rooms, and where we keep all of our supplies, chairs, tables, audio-visual equipment."
He paused.
"And although we have no restaurant, we arrange for buffets or cocktail parties, if clients request such service. That last thump..."
He didn't finish. As far as Clay was concerned, he didn't need to. That last thump had been a trolley, stacked high with glassware, being upended on the floor of the Iroquois room, where numerous other trolleys and tables had already been tipped over by some madman who was rampaging back and forth up there, buzzing around on the second floor like a bug trapped between the window and the screen, something without the wit to find a way out, something that could only run and break, run and break. Alice spoke up for the first time in nearly half an hour, and without prompting for the first time since they'd met her.
"You said something about someone named Doris?"
"Doris Gutierrez."
Mr. Riccardi was nodding.
"The head housekeeper. Excellent employee, probably my best. She was on 3 the last time I heard from her."
"Did she have..."
Alice wouldn't say it. Instead, she made a gesture that had become almost as familiar to Clay as the index finger across the lips indicating, "Shh." Alice put her right hand to the side of her face with the thumb close to her ear and the pinky in front of her mouth.
"No,"
Mr. Riccardi said, almost primly.
"Employees have to leave them in their lockers while they're on the job. One violation gets them a reprimand. 2, and they can be fired. I tell them this when they're taken on."
He lifted one thin shoulder in a half shrug.
"It's management's policy, not mine."
"Would she have gone down to the second floor to investigate those sounds?"
Alice asked.
"Possibly," Mr. Riccardi said. "I have no way of knowing. I only know that I haven't heard from her since she reported the wastebasket fire out, and she hasn't answered her pages. I paged her twice."
Clay didn't want to say, "You see, it isn't safe here either," right out loud, so he looked past Alice at Tom, trying to give him the basic idea with his eyes. Tom said,
"How many people would you say are still upstairs?"
"I have no way of knowing."
"If you had to guess?"
"Not many. As far as the housekeeping staff goes, probably just Doris. The day crew leaves at 3, and the night crew doesn't come on until 6.
Mr. Riccardi pressed his lips tightly together.
"It's an economy gesture. One cannot say measure because it doesn't work. As for guests..."
He considered.
"Afternoon is a slack time for us, very slack. Last night's guests have all checked out, of course. Checkout time at the Atlantic Inn is noon, and tonight's guests wouldn't begin checking in till 4 o'clock or so,
on an ordinary afternoon, which this most definitely is not. Guests staying several days are usually here on business, as I assume you were, Mr. Riddle.
Clay nodded without bothering to correct Riccardi on his name.
At mid-afternoon, business people are usually out doing whatever it was that brought them to Boston. So you see, we have the place almost to ourselves.
As if to contradict this, there came another thump from above them, more shattering glass, and a faint, feral growl. They all looked up.
Clay, listen, Tom said. If the guy up there finds the stairs, I don't know if these people are capable of thought, but...
Judging by what we saw on the street, Clay said, even calling them people might be wrong. I've got an idea that guy up there is more like a bug trapped between a window and a screen. A bug trapped like that might get out, if it found a hole. And the guy up there might find the stairs, but if he does, I think it'll be by accident.
And when he gets down and finds the door to the lobby blocked, he'll use the fire door to the alley,
Mr. Riccardi said with what was, for him, eagerness.
We'll hear the alarm. It's rigged to ring when anyone pushes the bar, and we'll know he's gone. One less nut to worry about.
Somewhere south of them, something big blew up, and they all cringed. Clay supposed he now knew what living in Beirut during the 1980s had been like.
I'm trying to make a point here, he said patiently.
I don't think so, Tom said. You're going anyway, because you're worried about your wife and son. You're trying to persuade us because you want company. Clay blew out a frustrated breath. Sure, I want company, but that's not why I'm trying to talk you into coming. The smell of smoke's stronger, but when's the last time you heard a siren? None of them replied. Me either, Clay said. I don't think things are going to get better in Boston, not for a while. They're going to get worse. If it was the cell phones.
She tried to leave a message for Dad, Alice said.
She spoke rapidly, as if wanting to make sure she got all the words out before the memory flew away.
She just wanted to make sure he'd pick up the dry cleaning because she needed her yellow wool dress for her committee meeting, and I needed my extra uni for the away game on Saturday. This was in the cab. And then we crashed. She choked the man, and she bit the man, and his turban fell off, and there was blood on the side of his face, and we crashed.
Alice looked around at their three staring faces, then put her own face in her hands and began to sob. Tom moved to comfort her. But Mr. Riccardi surprised Clay by coming around his desk and putting one pipe-stemmy arm around the girl before Tom could get to her.
There, there, he said. I'm sure it was all a misunderstanding, young lady.
She looked up at him, her eyes wide and wild.
Misunderstanding?
She indicated the dried bib of blood on the front of her dress.
Does this look like a misunderstanding? I use the karate from the self-defense classes I took in junior high. I use karate on my own mother. I broke her nose, I think. I'm sure.
Alice shook her head rapidly, her hair flying.
And still, if I hadn't been able to reach behind me and get the door open...
She would have killed you, Clay said flatly.
She would have killed me, Alice agreed in a whisper. She didn't know who I was. My own mother.
She looked from Clay to Tom.
It was the cell phones, she said in that same whisper. It was the cell phones, all right.
Chapter 14. So how many of the damn things are there in Boston? Clay asked. What's the market penetration?
Given the large numbers of college students, I'd say it's got to be huge, Mr. Riccardi replied.
He had resumed his seat behind his desk, and now he looked a little more animated. Comforting the girl might have done it, or perhaps it was being asked a business-oriented question.
Although it goes much further than affluent young people, of course. I read an article in Inc. only a month or two ago that claimed there's now as many cell phones in mainland China as there are people in America. Can you imagine?
Clay didn't want to imagine. All right, Tom was nodding reluctantly. I see where you're going with this. Someone, some terrorist outfit, rigs the cell phone signal somehow. If you make a call or take one, you get some kind of, what? Some kind of a subliminal message, I guess? That makes you crazy. Sounds like science fiction, but I suppose 15 to 20 years ago, cell phones as they now exist would have seemed like science fiction to most people.
I'm pretty sure it's something like that, Clay said. You can get enough of it to screw you up righteously if you even overhear a call. He was thinking of Pixie Dark. But the insidious thing is that when people see things going wrong all around them, their first impulse is to reach for their cell phones and try to find out what's causing it, Tom said.
Yeah, Clay said. I saw people doing it.
Tom looked at him bleakly.
So did I. What all this has to do with you leaving the safety of the hotel, especially with Doc coming on, I don't know, Mr. Riccardi said.
As if in answer, there came another explosion. It was followed by half a dozen more, marching off to the southeast like the diminishing footsteps of a giant. From above them came another thud and a faint cry of rage.
I don't think the crazy ones will have the brains to leave the city any more than that guy up there can find his way to the stairs, Clay said.
For a moment, he thought the look on Tom's face was shock, and then he realized it was something else. Amazement, maybe, and dawning hope.
Oh, Christ, he said, and actually slapped the side of his face with one hand.
They won't leave. I never thought of that.
There might be something else, Alice said.
She was biting her lip and looking down at her hands, which were working together in a restless knot. She forced herself to look up at Clay.
It might actually be safer to go after dark.
Why's that, Alice?
If they can't see you, if you can get behind something, if you can hide, they forget about you almost right away.
What makes you think that, honey? Tom asked.
Because I hid from the man who was chasing me, she said in a low voice. The guy in the yellow shirt. This was just before I saw you. I hid in an alley, behind one of those dumpster thingies. I was scared because I thought there might not be any way back out if he came in after me, but it was all I could think of to do. I saw him standing at the mouth of the alley, looking around, walking around and around, walking the worry circle, my grandpa would say, and at first I thought he was playing with me, you know, because he had to have seen me go into the alley. I was only a few feet ahead of him, just a few feet, almost close enough to grab.
Alice began to tremble.
But once I was in there, it was like, I don't know.
Out of sight, out of mind, Tom said. But if he was that close, why did you stop running?
Because I couldn't anymore, Alice said. I just couldn't. My legs were like rubber, and I felt like I was going to shake myself apart from the inside. But it turned out I didn't have to run anyway. He walked the worry circle a few more times, muttering that crazy talk, and then just walked off. I could hardly believe it. I thought he had been trying to fake me out, but at the same time I knew he was too crazy for anything like that.
She glanced briefly at Clay, then back down at her hands again.
My problem was running into him again. I should have stuck with you guys the first time. I can be pretty stupid sometimes.
You were scared, Clay began. And then the biggest explosion yet came from somewhere east of them, a deafening kerwham that made them all duck and cover their ears. They heard the window in the lobby shatter.
My God, Mr. Riccardi said.
His wide eyes underneath that bald head made him look to Clay like Little Orphan Annie's mentor, Daddy Warbucks.
That might have been the new Shell superstation they put in over on Neeland, the one all the taxis and the duck boats use. It was the right direction.
Clay had no idea if Riccardi was right. He couldn't smell burning gasoline, at least not yet. But his visually trained mind's eye could see a triangle of city concrete now burning like a propane torch in the lightning day.
Can a modern city burn? He asked Tom. One made mostly of concrete and metal and glass? Could it burn the way Chicago did after Mrs. O'Leary's cow kicked over the lantern?
That lantern-kicking business was nothing but an urban legend, Alice said.
She was rubbing the back of her neck as if she were getting a bad headache.
Mrs. Myers said so in American History.
Sure it could, Tom said. Look what happened to the World Trade Center after those airplanes hit it.
Airplanes full of jet fuel, Mr. Riccardi said pointedly.
As if the bald desk clerk had conjured it, the smell of burning gasoline began to come to them, wafting through the shattered lobby windows and sliding beneath the door to the inner office like bad mojo.
I guess you were on the nose about that Shell station, Tom remarked.
Mr. Riccardi went to the door between his office and the lobby. He unlocked it and opened it. What Clay could see of the lobby beyond already looked deserted and gloomy, and somehow irrelevant. Mr. Riccardi sniffed audibly, then closed the door and locked it again.
"Fainter already," he said.
"Wishful thinking," Clay said. "Either that or your nose is getting used to the aroma."
"I think he might be right," Tom said. "That's a good west wind out there, by which I mean the air's moving toward the ocean. And if what we just heard was that new station they put in on the corner of Neyland and Washington, by the New England Medical Center?" "That's the one, all right," Mr. Riccardi said.
His face registered glum satisfaction.
"Oh, the protests! The smart money fixed that, believe you?"
Tom overrode him. "Then the hospital will be on fire by now, along with anybody left inside, of course."
"No,"
Alice said, then put a hand over her mouth.
"I think yes. And the Wang Center's next in line. The breeze may drop by full dark, but if it doesn't, everything east of the Mass Pike is apt to be so much toasted cheese by 10 p.m.
"We're west of there,"
Mr. Riccardi pointed out. "Then we're safe enough," Clay said, "at least from that one." He went to Mr. Riccardi's little window, stood on his toes, and peered out onto Essex Street.
"What do you see?" Alice asked. "Do you see people?"
"No. Yes. One man, other side of the street."
"Is he one of the crazy ones?"
she asked.
"I can't tell."
But Clay thought he was. It was the way he ran, and the jerky way he kept looking back over his shoulder. Once, just before he went around the corner and onto Lincoln Street, the guy almost ran into a fruit display in front of a grocery store. And although Clay couldn't hear him, he could see the man's lips moving. "Now he's gone."
"No one else?" Tom asked.
"Not at the moment, but there's smoke." Clay paused. "Soot and ash, too. I can't tell how much. The wind's whipping it around."
"Okay, I'm convinced," Tom said. "I've always been a slow learner, but never a no-learner. The city's going to burn, and nobody's going to stand pat but the crazy people."
"I think that's right," Clay said. And he didn't think this was true of just Boston, but for the time being, Boston was all he could bear to consider. In time, he might be able to widen his view, but not until he knew Johnny was safe. Or maybe the big picture was always going to be beyond him. He drew small pictures for a living, after all. But in spite of everything, the selfish fellow who lived like a limpet on the underside of his mind had time to send up a clear thought. It came in colors of blue and dark, sparkling gold.
"Why did it have to happen today, of all days? Just after I finally made a solid strike." "Can I come with you guys, if you go?"
Alice asked. "Sure," Clay said. He looked at the desk clerk. "You can too, Mr. Riccardi."
"I shall stay at my post," Mr. Riccardi said.
He spoke loftily, but before they shifted away from Clay's, his eyes looked sick.
"I don't think you'll get in Dutch with the management for locking up and leaving under these circumstances," Tom said.
He spoke in the gentle fashion Clay was so much coming to like.
"I shall stay at my post," he said again. "Mr. Donnelly, the day manager, went out to make the afternoon deposit at the bank and left me in charge. If he comes back, perhaps then..." "Please, Mr. Riccardi," Alice said. "Staying here is no good."
But Mr. Riccardi, who had once more crossed his arms over his thin chest, only shook his head. Chapter 15. They moved one of the Queen Anne chairs aside, and Mr. Riccardi unlocked the front doors for them. Clay looked out. He could see no people moving in either direction, but it was hard to tell for sure because the air was now full of fine, dark ash. It danced in the breeze like black snow.
"Come on," he said.
They were only going next door to start with, to the Metropolitan Cafe.
"I'm going to relock the door and put the chair back in place," Mr. Riccardi said, "but I'll be listening. If you run into trouble, if there are more of those people hiding in the Metropolitan, for instance, and you have to retreat, just remember to shout, 'Mr. Riccardi, Mr. Riccardi, we need you.' That way I'll know it's safe to open the door. Is that understood?"
"Yes," Clay said. He squeezed Mr. Riccardi's thin shoulder. The desk clerk flinched, then stood firm, although he showed no particular sign of pleasure at being so saluted.
You're all right. I didn't think you were, but I was wrong.
I hope I do my best, the bald man said stiffly. Just remember. We'll remember, Tom said, and we'll be over there maybe 10 minutes. If anything goes wrong over here, you give a shout.
All right.
But Clay didn't think he would. He didn't know why he thought that. It made no sense to think a man wouldn't give a shout to save himself if he was in trouble. But Clay did think it.
Alice said, Please change your mind, Mr. Riccardi. It's not safe in Boston. You must know that by now.
Mr. Riccardi only looked away, and Clay thought, not without wonder,
This is how a man looks when he's deciding that the risk of death is better than the risk of change.
Come on, Clay said. Let's make some sandwiches while we've still got electricity to see by.
Some bottled water wouldn't hurt either, Tom said.